But welcome to everyone here. And it's great to have all of you. It's great to see so many familiar faces. It's wonderful for us to be gathering together as members and participants in this wonderful, beautiful industry of ours. I was asked to talk about capabilities that are relevant to the game industry and game farmers today. And I guess my intention is not to provide an exhaustive list, but to highlight some of the key capabilities that I believe are important for all of us today. And because of my business background, I also try to draw on my experiences at SAB, which spanned, by the way, a long and exciting 35-year period, and which turned out to be very learningful for me as well. In some respects, obviously, the topic of capability is probably somewhat of a dangerous topic. And I say that because often it's very easy to talk about it, but it's often and always very difficult to do, or at least do well. And I want to be careful. Over the past 25 years that I've been involved in game ranching, it has been a rewarding time for me. It's been a very satisfying time for me, and I've had some successes along the way. But the last thing I want to position myself as is some kind of expert. But there are five capabilities that I believe are very important and relevant for us today. Firstly, leadership attitude and orientation. Secondly, revenue growth management and cost containment. Thirdly, marketing and brand building. Fourthly, animal selection, evaluation and planning. And then fifthly, what I call the capability to build capability and skills development. Now, I'm going to touch on each of these subjects, and given the time that we've allocated today, I'll try to give you the short story. I'm not going to go into a long, in-depth discussion, although I could quite easily do it, but obviously we want to get on with the program. So let's start with the very first capability that I spoke about, leadership attitude and orientation. In my mind, this is the most important. And the best way I can describe this in summary is as follows. I've reflected on the successes and failures that I've had in business. And there are numerous observations and conclusions that I've come to. When you get to my age after you've retired, sometimes you reflect on things. So today, instead of trying to lecture all of you about what it takes to be successful as a leader in business in the game industry, I thought I would take a different approach to the subject and talk about telling you what it takes to fail. In my mind, this applies to any kind of business, not just the game business. So I'd like to share with you a few ideas that I call the 10 surefire ways or rules of preventing success in your wildlife business, or as I said, any business for that matter. And if anyone here is intent on preventing success as a leader and as a leader of the game business, you might want to jot some of these notes down and some of these rules down. So rule number one, stop taking risks. Rule number two, be inflexible. Rule number three, isolate yourself. Rule number four, assume infallibility. In other words, believe that you can never make a mistake. Rule number five, play the game close to the foul line. In other words, take chances that are borderline illegal or borderline unethical. Rule number six, don't take time to think. Rule number seven, put all your faith in consultants and outside experts. Rule number eight, send mixed messages. Rule number nine, and I believe this is one of the most important ones for all of us, is be afraid of the future. And rule number 10, lose your passion for what you do. In other words, lose your passion for life. So those are the 10 rules, guys, at the end of the day. And each of these rules, you will agree with me, follows basic common sense with a high degree of ethics and integrity. And I could tell a story relating to each of these rules that'll keep you here the whole day. But I think the idea is clear. The second capability I wanted to talk to you about is that of revenue growth management and cost containment. So when faced with conditions that are beyond our control, things like a troubled economy, things like political uncertainty and weaker demand, then we must not use those conditions to let up, but instead use these conditions as a motivator for innovation and creativity. In other words, and I've said this before in some of my talks, we must make reality our friend. Don't make reality your enemy. Successful people are often those that are at their best when their back's against the wall, because that is when they become most resourceful and most creative. And that's the mindset we must adopt right now, because it's critical for our success. And by the way, we are not alone as an industry, or even a country for that matter, that requires this mindset. So we should explore doing certain things differently and possibly revisit our business strategies, revisiting strategic choices in our business and getting sharper and more choiceful about these choices. Strategy is all about where to play and how to win. And often, in uncertain times, new opportunities present themselves. And there are many examples of revenue growth management which one should explore. Some of these are obvious. Some of these I'm just going to touch on. I can't get into all of them. But it's important to look to explore growing new revenue streams by considering diversification into areas of the wildlife value chain where one does not currently operate. We're talking about obvious things like hunting. We're talking about ecotourism. We're talking about game meat, other products and services. Often, this can be achieved at marginal extra cost and can make a big contribution, at least, to covering one's costs. Another example is really from a breeding perspective. There are great opportunities to make a step change in terms of the level or tier that one currently operates for a particular species in one's breeding herds. They are magnificent. They are outstanding animals that are coming available in the market only now, that have taken breeders years and years and many years of investment and much investment, which one now can acquire at a reasonable price. By acquiring some of these specimens, this will enable one to put one's stud breeding operation of a particular species, or a number of species for that matter, among the top tier of breeders in the country. And sometimes the most efficient way to do this is to acquire a top reading book, which will have an impact on one's whole herd from the get-go. And often the best time to invest is not in the boom times, but when prices are less exorbitant. And as a breeder, bear in mind, these are obvious statements. Quality always will always sell, always sells and will always sell. And also bear in mind, and I firmly believe this, that game ranching under the right conditions is still and will always be much more attractive than traditional stock farming. A third example about revenue growth management is that of private sales. Maximize the opportunity available to you. It doesn't matter what the size of your operation is. It doesn't matter the type of your operation. You should always have animals for sale at any point in time, at all times. Know their sizes, know their ages, price them correctly, have photographs readily available so that you can provide a potential buyer with instant information. So often we lose a sale because we don't have the information readily available and instantly available. And that we lose a sale, obviously, because we're unprepared. This applies equally to animals that we're selling for breeding stock, animals that we might be selling for hunting, animals that we might be selling for game meat. So just think of these small practical examples and always think about that. Obviously, the whole question of cost containment is another important capability. And you guys can tell me and give me many more ideas than I can on this subject. And the whole objective about cost containment is to reduce the break-even level of your business operation, your farming operation, by reducing your operating costs and finding resourceful ways to operate more cost-effectively and to operate more efficiently. Think about it this way. Start with your bigger cost items, like feed, like veterinary and other animal-related costs, like salaries and wages, and understand the underlying drivers of each of these costs. In very simplistic terms, the two biggest drivers are price and quantity of each of these costs. And then start to identify what in turn is driving the price, what in turn is driving the quantity of these costs, and explore alternative ideas of how you can change these or do them differently. Also, I would recommend that you draw up what I call a zero-based budget. By zero-based, I don't mean simply take last year's number that you actually spent and increase it by a percentage, or for that matter, take last year's number that you actually spent and decrease it by a number. Budget your costs as if you're starting from scratch with your new ideas and your new approaches. And then manage your costs according to this basis and understand the variances on a regular interval basis, on a short interval control basis, whether that's daily, whether that's weekly, whether that's monthly. So those, in simple terms, is what I would talk at in broad level about costs. But there are some practical examples that I thought might be worth mentioning. Let's talk about feed, one of our biggest cost items. There are many resourceful ideas out there, from bush clearing, which increases your grazing capacity, to more extensive camps, to planting your own quality grasses, to the use of kale food and other less expensive ingredients for your feed. However, at the end of the day, irrespective of which approach you're going to take, you need to know your grasses as well. Know the quality of your grazing. Know when to feed what animals, know what the right quantities are, and know when to use licks. Now, it's easy to say this, but it's very difficult to apply, and it's very relevant, because in this way, you can optimize the conditions of your animals. You won't compromise that, but at the same time, you'll minimize your costs. And you know the old story I'm reminded of. We don't just farm with wildlife, we actually farm the filth. So the more you understand your grasses, the more you understand the quality, the more you understand your animals, the much more effectively you can manage your costs. There's some other examples around veterinary and helicopter and capture costs. I'm sure you guys can tell me more stories than I can. You must avoid helicopter costs and immobilizing costs where you can, like using passive capture methods, obviously, or using Valium in your feed. And then if you do have to do pregnancy tests, you can immobilize those animals on the truck in a more cost-effective way. If you're going to use the helicopter and the vet, maximize the number of animals you do in a day. Try to set a minimum standard that you won't operate under unless you achieve a certain quantity and group a whole lot of activities together. And then you've got to plan your work well in advance. If you don't plan ahead, it's going to be expensive, guys. Lack of planning is costly. Avoid double handling where you can. Have the skill and the ability to judge animals at weaning age. And therefore, you don't have to then double handle or triple handle that animal. You take it straight from the weaning camp, put it into the hunting camp. So you're not going to end up double handling those animals or triple handling them. Again, easier said than done. Other, let's say, related animal costs. I'll give you a few other examples. If you know your buffalo herds well, we spoke about buffaloes earlier, and if you can identify them individually through their physical characteristics, not just some of the animals, all of the animals in the herd, as well as the calves, you could avoid immobilizing those buffalo and avoid microchipping. And in this way, you also save costs. But you've got to know your animals. You can't just do it. It'll be a disaster if you do it the other way around. You need not microchip sables or roan calves. Again, only if you know them and know them well and can easily identify them. And sometimes this is quite easy, particularly in a smaller camp or in a relatively smaller herd. Yaz Bateen was here today. Only use nuclear parentage and mitochondrial DNA tests where necessary. Again, you must know your parentage and animals in order to do this, together with good record-keeping systems. You can save on DIP and pesticides, and you can prevent diseases. We heard Johan talking earlier. Are they still here, by the way? I know Bettine's here. I don't know if Johan's still here. Yeah, dankie, Johan. Mooi. If you use rotational grazing camps for your sables and your roans in particular. Then it comes to your staff and their skills and their capabilities. Ensure that staff are skilled, that they're trained, that they're multi-skilled, that they are capable and can add value. This can save substantial costs. Or if you don't have that, it can cause you to incur substantial costs across your farming operation. These are obvious things, guys, but we need to constantly work towards these things. And I don't for one minute say that we've arrived at Numbu on all of these issues. These are all on our agenda. And, you know, some of them we're further ahead, some of them we're a little bit behind, but all of them we're pursuing. The third capability I thought I would talk to you about was marketing and brand building. From a marketing perspective, whatever sector or sectors of the wildlife industry you operate in, make sure you are shaping and designing your product, your services, your experiences to meet the needs of the market. And you need to understand the needs of the market. And they change. The total product itself is critical as well. Marketing is much more than communicating on fancy print ads or emails or videos or digital media or WhatsApp. It's much more than that. At SAB, I always used to tell my people, you're not just selling a beer, you're selling a brand. You're not just selling a brand, you're selling services and a reputation. And all of these things form an envelope around the product to make it more desirable, to make it more attractive to your consumer, to your customer. Building a brand is about consistently delivering a product, a service, an experience that is different, that is unique, that is special, and that meets the customer's needs once again, and that exceeds their expectations. The right product, together with reputation, together with integrity, together with authenticity, is fundamental. And how many guys get that wrong? We know it's obvious. We don't always stick to what we know. My definition of a brand, using my, let's say, business speak language, it's an emotional thought about a material difference. A brand is an emotional thought about a material difference. So material difference is something substantive. What makes it special or unique or different? The genotype, the phenotype, the performance values. Emotional connection is also very critical. Breeder's reputation, breeder's integrity, the breeder's after-sales service, his or her contribution to the industry, his support for the industry, his sharing of knowledge and giving of himself or herself to the industry and to the broader community goes a long way to creating this emotional connection with a brand. If you don't have the emotional connection, it doesn't matter how good your product is, ultimately, you're not going to have a brand, or you're going to have a brand that's not going to be able to realize its full potential. Also, remember, everything communicates, from the smallest detail about the neatness of the ranch, to the pride, to the passion that your staff and you reflect about your business and your ranch. At Nyumbu, we've consistently tried year after year to go out of our way to offer unique, special, top-end breeding stock to the market that is not available or easily available anywhere today. You've got your booklets in front of you. You know, when you get a chance, I'm sure you'll be able to have a look at it. But by the nature of our choices, these are animals that we ourselves wish to acquire. That's the approach we've adopted. We've chosen deliberately to do that. Simply, that's the acid test we apply. That's the litmus test we apply in order to assess whether our auction choices are correct. And we believe, unless we find the auction choice that we've made painful, we've not selected aggressively enough. And as we breed forward, so too does our quality on auction improve year on year. We also try to include magnificent breeding bull specimens that often represent unrelated lines to those generally available in the market. That's what we try to deliberately do, so that we can also appeal to a broader cross-section, not just the big breeders. So when you're thinking about your product, you've also got to think about what does the market need and what need can you potentially fulfill, even if it's a latent need. Often smaller breeders, as I said earlier, in order to make a big and quick impact on their herds, will seek out top bulls. And this year, the approach that Nyumbu's taken is no different. It's just that, despite the fact that we know that the market is not as robust as previous years. Now, this approach is not necessarily one that all breeders should adopt. I'm not saying there's a one-size-fits-all, that's how you go about marketing. Because in most instances, top breeders will not sell from among their very best. They would rather hold on to them. And that having said, it does not mean that they are wrong and Nyumbu is right. No one is right or wrong. I'm just using it as an example to highlight that you have to get very clear on what the choice of approach that you are taking. And then tailor your communications and tailor your targeting of your market accordingly, of what you then feel is best for you in your operation and your circumstances. Not everybody's circumstances are the same. So there's no simple answer that says, listen, turn to page 20 and you just follow that and everything will be fine. And I believe only once you are clear on your total offering, having understood the needs of the market, then do you consider your communication strategy for your target market or your target markets. And when it comes to marketing communication, you need to consider, very importantly, the efficiency of that communication and the effectiveness. So that communication is a point of contact. What does it cost you to exercise that communication media that you use? How many people do you reach with a point of contact, and how efficient is it? That's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it, and you need to look at it as well, is what is the effectiveness of that communication? And so what you can't just do is just go for efficiency or just go for effectiveness. You've got to go for the optimize the clout, they call it the clout factor. So you want to be efficient, but you want to be effective. And not all of the communication medias are going to give you that clout factor. You've got to think about that as well. So the notion, I think in summary, that good marketing skills allows some people to sell a hollow Easter egg is absolute nonsense. And that good marketing is all about spin. That is naive and unsustainable if you do that. People are not stupid. They can sift the chaff from the wheat. So when you market, you've got to think logically. It's not about how much you can spin around a particular product or animal or whatever it might be. And unfortunately, there are no shortcuts. You might get away with it in the short term, but not in the long term. And it's often about what you do, not what you say, that matters in the marketplace. So that's in summary what I wanted to say about marketing. Obviously, again, it's a subject we can talk forever on. And having been involved in consumer goods around the world, that's a subject that occupied my time substantially. And marketing's not something that you leave to the marketing department. It's far too important to leave to the marketing department. So if you as a leader are not involved in the marketing in one form or another, not in the pushing email buttons, etc., that's not what I'm talking about. But you've got to have your business has got to be orientated around marketing. And that's what we at WRSA are trying to do. We're looking to focus externally. We're looking to create demand for the future, for the industry. We're looking to stimulate that demand. We're looking to create an enabling environment for that industry and for the growth in that industry to thrive. But let me not get sidetracked. I saw Tobogo there, so I started sidetracking. But the fourth capability I wanted to talk to you about was animal selection, evaluation, and planning. You know, this is another relevant and important capability which will enable you, among others, to select the right animals to breed, to select the right animals for sale that will deliver value to your buyer so that that buyer comes back to you again and again over the years, to enable you to make informed decisions regarding breeding, your breeding plan, and to identify winning combinations in order to achieve ambitious breeding outcomes which produce disproportionate percentage of magnificent specimens, which in turn will strengthen your top line growth and your brand. And obviously, this in turn will help reduce the time it takes to get there. And this capability is as much about practice as science. Now, we heard from Bettine today about the science, some of the science, and what's available today and what's potentially going to be available in the future. But fundamentally, there is no substitute, doesn't matter how much science you've got, for spending time in the veld, for evaluating and assessing your animals, and knowing your animals and their background, and what to look for by species, and keeping meticulous records. I'm stating the obvious, guys, but it's important. The better you know your animals, the more accomplished and capable you will become. And you can be aided by tools. You can use tools. Use tools like genetics, like DNA, like parentage, like whatever you want, but unrelatedness or genetic diversity of your herds. In order to assist you. You can use tools like photo records. Use tools like analytics and comparisons of growth versus averages at different ages. That's also important. Know your stats well. If you don't measure, you won't be able to manage. Knowledge of influential bloodlines and existing bulls in the industry. Genetic information I've spoken about and tests. But in my mind, the beautiful and possibly attractive thing about breeding is that there's no fixed success formula. And nobody knows all the answers. I mean, how long have they been breeding cattle for? And you tell me there's a formula. Doesn't matter how much genetics you throw at the thing. You can't just open the book and produce a top outstanding animal just by pushing a button. And that's the beauty of our industry. And there are many, very many successful breeders out there with completely different approaches and philosophies to breeding. And they are successful. Not everyone's successful, but there are many successful ones that adopt different approaches. But the important thing when it comes to breeding is that you must always have a plan. The fact that your plan is different from the other guy doesn't matter. Mindless breeding will never get you there. So you've got to have a plan. And if that plan doesn't work, you know that that's the plan you used, and then you can course correct off that plan. And if it does work, you know that that's how you continue and you get better at it. So some of the learnings that have influenced my approach over time are, and I believe this, not everybody believes this, and I'm not always right. I'm not pretending to be right, but I'm sharing you some of my the learnings that have influenced me. Breed ultimately for genetic diversity. And we've heard from Johan, we heard from Bettine. I believe if you do line breeding, and I'll come to line breeding versus inbreeding later, do so to fix certain traits and then move to outbreed again. And that will avoid some of the complications that we've heard from both Johan and Bettine. And I mean, they always say that line breeding, you call it line breeding when it's successful, you call it inbreeding when it's not successful. But anyway, breeding plans should compromise either complementary breeding or corrective breeding. Preferably, the sooner you can just get onto complementary breeding, the better. Your breeding plan should reflect clear choices, either combining unrelated animals for hybrid vigor from the get-go. Now, you don't need to have genetic tests about relatedness in order to work out what's an unrelated animal. If you know your animals well, and if you know where they came from, you can add one and one, and you're going to get to two. So either combining unrelated animals, as I said, for unrelated for hybrid vigor, or line breeding to secure certain traits and then to outbreed with unrelated lines thereafter, and which themselves could be line bred. So you could have two line bred, different line bred animals that you match, and that will outbreed, or combinations of these. You know, these are some of the learnings I've picked up and some of the approaches I've adopted. And at the same time, you need to be upgrading your herds based on phenotype. You don't need geneticists to tell you about the phenotype. You can look at the animal. And traits like fertility. You've got to know your fertility of your animals. And the probability, in my mind, that a good-looking animal will breed a good-looking animal is high. I mean, obviously, Bettine's saying in 5-10 years' time, we're going to be able to predict that. But at the same time, a good-looking phenotype most probably and most likely will produce a good one. Not guaranteed, but will most. It's got a higher probability. Sometimes, however, obviously, they're individual female animals, or bulls for that matter, that are less impressive, that can be producers of outstanding animals. And there are examples in the industry that we know about. And you need to identify them in your herds today. So if you've got a 27-inch buffalo cow that you say, no, this is no bloody good, I must get rid of her, she might be one of your best-producing bull females, mothers. But you've got to know that. It's no good speculating. And you keep her, obviously. Other females combine well with certain bulls to produce outstanding animals. So sometimes the animal itself, whichever bull you use, is top end. Sometimes it's about combinations that match the best. So when identifying and selecting cows for breeding plan, it's not just about phenotype, but breeding performance and matches that also need to be factored in. But again, in order to do this, you need to know your animals, their history, their lineage, and preferably their genetic makeup and how they breed. So in summary, know your animals well in order to breed well. That is the essence of breeding forward. And just like any successful business, always benchmark. I mean, SAB, I think one of the things that propelled SAB forward was that we had this inherent culture in our business where we were never satisfied. We were always striving. We were always comparing ourselves with ourselves and with the outside world. And we always wanted to get better, no matter how good you are. You can always get better. And the way to know where you are in the continuum is to benchmark. Benchmark with yourself as well as leading industry players and ensure that you are staying ahead, that you're moving ahead, that you're breeding ahead, you're breeding forward. Compare your stats between different herds. Compare between sires with other breeders and learn and adapt. There's a lot of trial and error, guys, in breeding. However, you want to position yourself to be a quick learner. You don't want to take 20 years when you can actually take 5 or 2 years to learn these things. And then the last capability I thought I would talk about was the capability to build capability and skills development. And one of the biggest challenges for any business is to assess the potential of your staff and then get those staff to be the best they can be and deliver value to achieve your business model and your strategy. And one of the six values that we strive to achieve at Nyumbu is that people are our enduring advantage. But this can only be true if each staff member is delivering continuous added value, no matter what level they operate at. And I think we as ranchers don't leverage the full potential of all of our staff. We've got guys that operate in our business that are unbelievably talented, that have got skills that we never realized they had, that are better than us. And they can add value to your game plan in terms of the way you want to go forward. So leverage that skill. Unlock that skill. Take risks. And strive, again, to get those skills levels where you want them to be. And anyone who tells me that they've arrived on all dimensions, he'll be talking the biggest lot of nonsense. And so individually and collectively, your business should aim to achieve all of these capabilities, these five capabilities I spoke about, as well as capabilities that Johan spoke about around diseases, identifying diseases, managing disease prevention. Those are all capabilities. I'm not giving you an exhaustive list. In order to ensure long-term success and competitive advantage. So the five I gave you are just some of the ones that I felt were highly relevant and very important for all of the game ranches. And I think one of the biggest mistakes we would try to make would be to try and master all of these capabilities at the same time, all at once. And it may be more wise to actually sequence the way you go about doing it. First master one, then go on to the other one. Don't try and do everything at the highest standard that you've set yourself immediately. You won't get there. But without the right leadership approach and orientation, you'll never get this right. So my belief is you've got to start with leadership, attitude and orientation, and that capability. So, guys, I think I did stick to my time. Eta, JP, I said I would overrun. But I just want to take this opportunity to thank so many people. I want to thank Tebogo for taking the time to be here. And his leadership of WRSA is invaluable, and it's going to be even more valuable to us going forward. I want to thank all the speakers. I mean, we had world-class speakers here today, people. You don't realize how privileged we are. That's why I've got so much faith in this industry. South Africa's got comparative advantage that no other country's got in the world when it comes to wildlife. And I've spoken to Cyril, and I'm going to still bend his ear, that one of the potential opportunities for our country to solve many of our challenges is this economy of wildlife. Not necessarily exactly how the form it takes today, but certainly we've got comparative advantage. And why not grow an industry where you've got comparative advantage, where you can be globally competitive, than trying to grow an industry that you've got no chance to compete with the rest of the world? And that's what our industry offers. And I could give you another long speech about that, but I'm not going to. I can't, because I'll get into trouble. But so I want to thank Johan and Bettine. I mean, we've got world-class experts in our industry, and they are two leaders in the world that can, you know, are going to enable us to go forward as an industry. And no other country's got that. You can go around the world; you're not going to get that. Genuinely, just as an example, and it's not just limited to these experts. I also want to thank the organizers, Jenny and your team from Tabazimbi. I want to thank Stefan Nodia and the Pilansberg guys. And I want to thank all of you guys for making the effort to be here today. We're going to be going on a game drive soon. We're going to have lunch. JP's going to tell us what's happening next. But don't forget your booklets with you when we go on the game drive. But I want to thank all of you for coming. We really feel honored that you took the time, and we're privileged that you took the time to be with us today. And then lastly, but not least, to thank my staff, JP, Henno, Yolandi, Jenny, Natasha, everyone, Michael. I mean, there's so many people to thank from Nyumbu's side. They made me really proud, and I just want to thank them. I did nothing. They did everything. Thanks, JP. And thanks, everyone, for being here.